to a Saturday night on KABC. My name is Bill Jenkins. We call these next 3 hours Open Mind. We want to open your mind perhaps to something new, and we do have something new for you. For a lot of you, you need to have an open mind about the reality of the flying saucer, the extraterrestrial. We'll give you something to think about tonight, so come on in for the next time. There are extraterrestrials, it would seem. There are beings from other places that come to visit us on Earth, and from time to time they drop down and talk to some of our population. True, they have never talked to me, that I know about, but we do know a number of people that they have talked to. And we know a number of people who have spent a great deal of time and effort in studying this particular activity that seems to be going on, who have spent a lot of time collecting data. And more than just data, in many cases, hardware and artifacts and things that we can touch and see that are imprints of the extraterrestrial who have been here. And we have some ideas of why and what they're doing. And to help us with that tonight is a gentleman who certainly has been deeply involved in one of the cases that, in fact, it was the case of the very that we dealt with on the very first Open Mind show back in 1979, the Billy Meyer case. Billy Meyer, one-armed farmer in Switzerland, started reporting that he was having an unusual series of occurrences in his life, and that was a visitation from astronauts who claimed to be from the planet Era, located in the Pleiades star cluster. Now, I know that that's very hard and difficult for us to just assimilate and accept matter-of-factly. And Billy Meyer knew that, too, so he did produce a lot of evidence that this was pretty much the case. The evidence came in the form of photographs and movie footage, came in the form of rock and mineral samples and samples of alloy. And with us tonight is a gentleman who has spent time himself with Billy Meyer, who's become very, very involved in what Billy Meyer has learned from the people from Pleiades, and I'd like for you to say hello to him. And, George, you say hello to the folks. This is George Green. Welcome to Open Mind, George.
Good evening.
Glad to have you there. Pull that a little bit closer to you, it'd be all right. Why, and what is it about the Billy Meyer case that attracted your attention, and why would you be interested at all anyway?
Well, I was personally involved with one connection.
Push that little red button. There you go.
I was personally involved with a connection where I had observed a flying saucer, as we quote them, when I was in the Air Force. We had one of the craft at one of the bases that I was at, and
when you were in the Air Force, a craft, a flying saucer, something from another world, was in the possession of the United States Air Force at that Air Force military base, and you saw
it? Yes.
Okay.
We were told to tell the public if they saw it that it was an iron-powered craft designed by Sikorsky, and that was all that was said.
I imagine that would have been a bulletin to Sikorsky that they were designing that craft.
Well, I was assigned to a research center, and we were working on a lot of aircraft, so everything was kind of hush-hush. And
what air base was this?
Edwards Air Force Base.
It was at Edwards Air Force Base.
That's true.
So you yourself stand as an eyewitness, as a member of the American military, the Air Force, at Edwards Air Force Base, and you saw this craft in one of the hangars at Edwards Air Force Base.
That's true.
Okay. Go ahead.
From that point on, I was aware of different sightings because I read the papers and I listened to the different information like everybody else has. A few years back, I ran across the copy of UFO Contact from the Pleiades, Volume 1, that was put out by Genesis. And in it had the most fantastic photographs that I had seen. I had to get a copy of that for my own collection. I attempted in several methods to get a hold of it, and with no success, I finally flew down and talked to the publishers and agreed to help them get out the Volume 2, in which we did do.
So you put some money in the publishing of Volume 2?
Yes, I did.
So you really did get interested in it enough to reach into your pocketbook?
I financed the project so it could go on. From that point on, I decided to check into even more information, and I flew to Switzerland. Was there a couple of times where this contact actually went on. And I met Billy and met the rest of the people, did a lot of my own investigation so I could feel comfortable with the information I had, realizing that anybody can create things. the evidence is preponderance to us. The people there are very exacting in what the information they're given. It's all the same information. There is some occurrence that's going on, has been coming on, and is still going on.
Mm-hmm.
Billy is a very spiritual person who has nothing to gain, not economically at least. He would like to be supporting and receive something out of these things because he's been bombarded by everybody from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
His information, or his mission, so to speak, to the general public and to the world was to give out the information. He has been given this mission, so to speak, to correct some mistakes that the Palladians say they've done in previous history.
What kind of mistakes have the Palladians done?
Well, they have always picked, it seems like, people that are not highly technical to give the information to, and they were to disseminate it or tell the people what they felt was correct. And people, like they do today, say, lay laugh about it, and they won't accept it.
Mm-hmm.
The Palladians went into a big role with the time of Jesus as such.
Mm-hmm.
They were in communication with him, and it seems to appear from documentation that he actually was in communication with him.
Mm-hmm.
Billy, as far as it may seem, was actually taken back in time to meet him.
Yes, I've heard those stories, and they're quite fascinating, and you have to look at them from two different points of view. Number one, it is something that Billy is relating. You have to look at the validity of the other information that he has given you. And a lot of that seems to be very, very valid. So why would he just make this out? You know, it's hard for us to understand the ability to move back and forth in time. But we are, and as we've discovered on the show from time to time from different sources, that this is certainly something that's not out of our realm of scientific understanding right now, the ability to do that.
No, the areas that he was discussing and going back, they did give us evidence that he did have some kind of transferring in time. He stopped by a priest in France that the Palladians were in contact a few hundred years ago. And while he was there, absentmindedly he left his flashlight. And now we have story independently that this priest in France had a magic torch. No explanation, but we do have a book which seems to independently verify that there's something going on from him. Now, Billy didn't make this up. It just happened. The second information that we get was that there was a Greek priest who was doing some translating of some material that was in resin, supposedly the writings of the time of Jesus from Judas. And these writings that were being translated were of such a tenuous nature, we'll say, that the Greek priest was subsequently killed for. The Palladians were in contact with this Greek priest. Subsequently, Billy became the contactee, and he took over this task also. Now, this is just one of the areas. Some of the other information, and it's all, there's approximately 2,000 pages of notes that Billy had, was written down from a telepathic communication basis.
Mm-hmm.
Billy would go up into one of the beam ships or be in contact with them, either telepathically or in direct communication. Somehow when he came back, and in Billy's words was, his mind became almost like a blank, and he would be able to sit down in like an automatic writing, or he would start typing. And he could type out the information word for word. And his contactee, a girl by the name of Semyasi, explained to him, as he asked her further, that he felt like he was just being plugged into a computer and reprogrammed word for word what had happened to him. And she verified that that was the information. So Billy was on a big exploration of the whole communications that they were given.
Mm-hmm.
And it appears somehow that Billy happens to have some kind of a frequency of his mind that he's generating, so that he's being observed by a lot of ETs. When I was over there last year, I talked to a neighbor farmer, and he walked out in the morning and said, a lot of interesting things going out there. And he says, last week when I got up, I walked out and there was a man 7 meters tall leaning against the barn. 7 meters being about 21 feet.
That's a pretty big sun.
Yeah. And then we went back up and talked to the group around Billy, and they were discussing people that were 10 inches tall. And they showed us plaster casts of the footprints that they had. And they were trying to explain that they're being visited by all kinds of ETs. They may not be there physically. They may come in and have leave lights or traces or things that's going on, but Billy appears to just be a magnet for all these people coming around.
Sort of a port in a storm, as it were.
Well, I think I just come back from China. It's kind of like when I was there. Everybody took us out to see the panda bear. I think Billy's in the same position. A lot of somehow in this collective, you know, universe, they say, well, drop by and see Billy. He's tuned into us.
Yeah.
And so that's what they do.
Does he get a chance to talk with him much? Or communicate with him? Or are they just roam around?
He doesn't go into a lot of detail. He does communicate with quite a few of them. But he wants to. He doesn't say a lot outside of his own group because he's been, you know, chastised so much from people. At this point, he just said, I have my mission. Here's the information. Take it for what you want. I got involved because I wanted to get all the information out, let the people maybe be their own judge. The notes, which we have copies of, are so fascinating. Because even though they're things that I would say as a scientist or analytically looking at them, say, well, now that's not going to be possible, as things keep progressing, they are possible. Because there's nothing that we find that's not impossible with our mind thoughts. They give us a lot of clues on how their propulsion works. I've been comparing them, the Palladian connection with Billy, with other connections with Wendell Stevens, who's been doing research on this also, on other extraterrestrial contacts throughout the world. And they seem to have a lot of same similarities and same goals that they find out.
And the propulsion systems.
And the propulsion systems. The key seems to be, in all the stories they talk about, there's a crystal of some kind. And the crystal appears to be a collector. And it seems to be enhanced. In our own terminology today, we have a lot of computers that are running by solar now. Everybody buys a little solar computer. So you're collecting the light. It's being transferred to a small computer. They somehow are enhancing the power, taking out what they say the light again, and use this as a collector source in order to increase a frequency variation above aboard their ships. And this seems to be the power that they use for travel throughout the universe and in time. They do say in their notes that no humans, quote, have ever used a carbon-based system for interplanetary travel. Their communication say that the travel that we went to the moon and all this is all within our little structure, and that's always happened. And they had the same problems of life and death when they were experimenting with it. But when they find the secret of frequency and the secret of collecting the light, and there's some clue into this, and through the crystalline structure, then we will have the keys in order to unlock the power of travel interdimensionally through other planets.
So we no longer need to burn fossil fuels of one form or another.
The changes in the fossil fuels in the last 50 years, for instance, we were talking about the sperm whale. Everybody was up in the air because that was the only way we could light our lamp.
Uh-huh.
And we were going to killing off the sperm whale. Now what we have? All the oil wells and everything else. And we're going to do the same thing. The next energy source that we have to look at has to be something to do with the natural waves throughout the universe. And it seems to be a key in all the universal contacts that we get. And it is done by some form of electromagnetism.
We've discussed that at great length of this this program, this the new wave of energy that is descending upon us quite rapidly. And it falls quite much in line with what you're saying is coming out of the Billy Meyer notes. The science that is already with us and that is in the laboratory and is being studied very, very closely by a lot of people. The thing that's interesting to me is the contact now with Billy Meyer, or the interest in the people from Pleiades in him, seems to have waned here recently. What's happening?
Well, Billy was given a mission.
Mm-hmm.
To get out the information. And I think that's the information, however, that was given out somehow or whatever way, method was made so was not got out to the public. I think that the general public should be able to look at 100% of what the information that they have, and rather than having it...
little bits and pieces.
Little bits and pieces, a little here and a little there. It's not for me to judge whether the validity or not. This is the information that he has. It appears that the information is from their point of view, whether the Pleiadians or whether it's Billy's mind has come out, the information that shows that there is a lot going on, and it makes you ponder and think.
Well, there seems to be a lot going on. I know we've talked about on the show before, a couple of months ago, there was quite a formation of flying saucers appeared over Tucson, Arizona. Just before I came on the air tonight, I got another report from Tucson that it happened again yesterday and was seen by a lot of people, and we will have a report from Tucson a little later on in the show as to what happened. About 60 of them flew over Tucson again. Of what interest do they have in Tucson?
Well, this happened, like you say, a couple months ago, and I contacted Colonel Stevens, and we discussed it. Then we contacted Switzerland, and I discussed it with the group over there, indirectly two of the members, to discuss with Billy whether or not the Pleiadians were in communication at that time. And the story that we got back was that the Pleiadians were pulling out. They had a base around Tucson. Now, I heard this before.
Mm-hmm.
They'd left before because their contact in Tucson wasn't able to get the information out, or he was working on some other area. And I don't know. The Pleiadians had their own understanding of what they wanted to let us know. But they did say that there was a base there and that they were going to be leaving the Earth for some reason. In Switzerland, they have just left. I think there's three of them left as of the last couple months, we understand, of a group that was maybe 50 or 60 that was in a base that they had in the Swiss mountains. They tell us that if we walk right up to the place, that we wouldn't be able to see it because they could alter our mind if we happen to be looking for them, which also appears happening in a lot of cases.
Well, that ends that expedition. I was thinking about going over to find that unused base. It might have been a fascinating thing to see. Let's take a break. I'm talking to George Green right now. This is not the George Green of KABC, our beloved boss, but he's George Green, a successful businessman from Denver, Colorado, one-time member of the Air Force, and did see in one of the hangars at Edwards Air Force Base a flying saucer that the Air Force had there, has become very interested in the Billy Meyer case and UFOs in general, and has spent a great deal of his time and his wealth in separating the wheat from the chaff in this particular subject. And we'll be back to it in just a moment. Did a recent poll, I think it was a Gallup poll, taken that the majority of Americans believe that there are extraterrestrials in Earth space. Many hundreds of thousands have seen them, but yet our government says, nah, there's no such thing exists. And if you go to newsrooms of newspapers, television stations, and radio stations across the country, the news editors will guffaw at all of that sort of stuff. But there is something very serious going on. As we've discussed before on this show, the Freedom of Information Act has released volumes of material from the federal government confirming the fact that there are extraterrestrials, there are flying saucers. Some of our greatest minds and generals, like George C. Marshall and Douglas MacArthur, have stated in their literature that is now public domain that you can read with their signature that there are flying saucers, and General MacArthur thought that's where our greatest problem was going to be, was from the people of space. But yet a lot of time people just want to sit back and kind of smile at that. It's much better to be involved in the latest wreck on the freeway, I guess. The flying saucer that you saw at Edwards Air Force Base, what did it look like?
It was similar to like a variation 2 or a variation 3 of the beam ships presented by the plating. It was a round circular disc with a, dome in the center of it. Small craft. It appears from now, after 20-some years later, looking at the craft that we see pictures of, it probably was from the planet of the Reticula, or the Stark.
Mm-hmm. The Reticulan ships, right?
Uh-huh. It was a very, a small craft. It was approximately 30 feet across.
Well, many of the ships from Pleiades are about that size, aren't they, the ones that we see most of the time?
True, they're one or two men craft.
Or women craft.
Or people craft.
People craft, in their case.
Right.
You're talking about the pictures. Are those magazines, are those marvelous books available? I know I used to have a number of copies of Volume 1. And somehow or another, those slipped out of my library. They just disappeared. Coincided with a visitation from somebody, usually. I do have a volume two. Volume one is just unobtainable, I suppose, isn't it?
They're pretty hard to come by.
Right? Yeah.
We have some of the volume twos available for people that are interested in getting them, and they can write to us.
I want to give that address because I know a lot of people are interested in that.
Yeah, if they would just write to America West, and our address is Box 441335, Aurora, that's A-U-R-O-A-R-A, Colorado, 80044. We'll send them a list of all the different books that we have that are involved with UFOs.
Well, you're into more than just the Billy Meyer case, I understand. What are some of the other cases that have come across your desk that seem to have great merit?
Well, we just come back from Spain, and there's a case there that is very highly technical, and we're working with Colonel Stevens on the translating and the distribution of the information of the UMOs. And the UMOs seem to be willing to share their technical information. The problem that we find out with the technical information is that we haven't been able to put it to work yet. It's similar to a story that Wendell Stevens provided us with, a case in South America of the UFO occupants, so to speak, were mating with some South Americans in Brazil. We actually have a half-breed going on. And part of the family had developed some kind of tumor of the body, and the extraterrestrials provided a salve to rub on the palms and also on the bottom of their feet. And this salve would go be absorbed into the system, and then a couple days later, a crust would form on the bottom of their palms and also the bottom of their feet, and the tumor would be dissolved from their body. I did get some of this salve and took it to Chemitox Labs in Boulder, Colorado, which is a famous laboratory. They ran for 2 days the spectrographic analysis of the material, and it doesn't match up with anything. The problems that we discussed with the doctor that does this up there, he says, it appears that the universe has all the same elements, but not necessarily in the same order.
Mm-hmm.
So even though they give us the technical information, we haven't been able to rearrange the atoms, so to speak. Now, simplicity speaking, we all know that water's formula is H2O, but technically it's not. It's HOH, or a hydrogen atom, and an OH atom. But what happens if we rearrange the atoms so it would be HHO?
Mm-hmm.
That happens to be the little differentiations that we have throughout the universe. Could be still the same atoms, but just rearranged in the molecular order.
It would still be water, but a different kind of water.
Could be, and that's what we're finding out with, like, this salve. Before we could rearrange all the multitude of items within the salve that we had, we first have to determine how to get to that that position, and we were unable to do that. So therefore, we have an unidentified substance that appears to do what they're saying, but we can't recreate it. Meanwhile, we go back to the Pleiadians, and I listen to their story, and they say, yes, if we would take all of our technology and go for a positive vein, we would be able to obtain all of the information they have in the next 200 to 300 years.
Or maybe even faster if we'd set our mind to it.
There's a lot of these things that are being made available to us through other sources, that it appears that we would have all the information if we could all collectively utilize what they're providing to us. Again, we have to go back to saying, well, is this fact or not? It appears that it has a lot of validity to it, and we have to sort out what is the malarkey in it, so to speak, and what is real.
Well, you see, we also have in the ethic of our society a great problem with great advances in technology. If we suddenly appear with a great quantum leap advance in technology, it will probably not get off the ground because we have such vested interest in the old technology. And it takes those the entrepreneurs, or the ones that have the money and the marketing and these things, to get them on the market, to get something really new and good into the hands of the people, and they're not about to do it at the expense of all of the other investment that they've got going on. Kind of a sad catch-22 that we have put ourselves in on this planet.
It would appear that the extraterrestrials are aware of this, and even though that the most of the ones that we have information on have a hard time understanding the concepts that we do of the capitalistic structure. They do understand the natural evolution, and they try to set back as our brother. They passively want to get involved,
mm-hmm.
and then independently they get involved and reveal a bunch of information, and they say that they were directly involved in providing a lot of this information to us from our previous history. It's like our discussing UFOs per se on the radio tonight. You would also have the same problem going down and discussing something way ahead of this, whether the Pleiadians are discussing they're ahead 3,500 years, and yet they're in communication with people that are 5,000 or 10,000 years ahead of them technologically.
Like the Dal universe.
Like the Dal universe. So they're all interchanging ideas, but they only do it when the consciousness is raised enough to allow this information to come through.
Well, certainly if you were to allow information to come to this planet that was that quantum leap, and the planet wasn't ready for it, you've wasted your time.
That's one of the reasons that they look at all. They are very, very much afraid of nuclear energy. They feel that's the only thing that bothers them, that they would interfere. The rest of us killing off each other, that's just a day-to-day thing. But the nuclear energy, when the blasts go by, it seems we always have sightings of UFOs around them. And they explain that they want to watch this. They watch our primitive playing around with our firecrackers. But the nuclear energy actually affects interdimensionally, which we theorize but don't understand at this point, but it affects them.
So we're shooting in someone else's backyard whenever we fire those off.
We're affecting life not only on our planet, but all planets throughout the system.
Which could get somebody very unhappy.
Which they are very much watching out for.
Mm-hmm. The UMOs, this was the group first in Spain. As I recall in talking to Wendell, it seemed that they did provide some technology over there that dealt with photography.
That's true.
Yeah. What kind of technology did they give us?
Well, I'm in a process right now of providing the money to put out the book on the UMO case.
Mm-hmm.
And I was more going in rather than the photography in it. Again, I'm looking at propulsion on the book.
Uh-huh.
On a personal basis. And I was just correlating their propulsion methods along with the Pleiadians. The photographic information, I really didn't spend my time that I wanted to with them on that.
But they did develop some technology in Spain based upon that information, I understand.
That's what I understand, too. I hope a little later on tonight we'll be able to talk to Wendell.
We're going to try. We're trying our best to talk to Wendell, and we'll try to get through to him and his daughter tonight so that they can add something to the subject. We're talking about the extraterrestrial. The Billy Meyer case, certainly paramount in that, I think, one of the better known, if not the best known, of the contact cases, but certainly not the only one that is going on, and it still seems to be going on now. And we'll also try to get some reports from Tucson live for you tonight about a squadron of UFOs that was sighted over that city just yesterday. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's openly really going on. George is expressing to us the idea that it is really going on. He has seen one parked in a hangar at Edwards Air Force Base while he was in the Air Force himself some time ago. I'm going to let the audience talk to you a little bit, George. Let them ask questions. You know, they're the best interrogators of them all. Let me give you the numbers for you to call in and talk to George tonight.
Hi. Good evening. How are you, Mr. Jenkins? Welcome back from Fiji.
Well, it's good to be back.
And Mr. Reed, how are you this evening?
Very good.
Yes, I've done some work and proceeding with some work with Lee Elders of the Genesis Publishing Company, and of course his involvement with Billy Myers. And one of the unfortunate things is that Mr. Myers seems to be have been affected physically by and mentally by the UFO presence. And I mentioned to him I do biomagnetic work, and that perhaps some biomagnetic treatments might be of assistance to it. I wonder if you know about that and could comment on that. And can I relate a story to you? There was couple of months ago when Mr. Elders was on, he played a tape, audio tape of the UFO sounds. And I've been experimenting with the sound to see what would happen. And one of the interesting things is that just for fun, I decided to play it on my CB walkie-talkie on channel 14, matter of fact. And after I'd done that, my lights started to flicker and They went out a couple of times, so I don't know if I was contacting anybody or anything, but it was kind of spooky. So could you comment on the if any other people have been affected by UFO, physically, medically?
I can tell you about Billy. Billy's in pretty good health right now. He did have an accident, a tractor accident, and fell off and hit his head. He seems to be aging, however. There's some speculation that this travel that he's done on aboard the craft has caused some kind of premature aging.
Uh-huh.
Billy seems to be in good health last time I was over there. And then, of course, talking to Switzerland this last week, they said everything is fine and Billy is getting around and, is able to talk to people.
Uh-huh.
He doesn't listen that you have of other people being affected. All of the extraterrestrial contacts that have seemed to have a contact with the ETs have some things that are similar to them. I've been talking to Dr. Sprinkle, who's been doing another case of where he's age regressed through hypnosis, over 100 people that have supposedly had contact. And he is coming up with some similarities in a substantial amount of them. And some things do affect him.
Mm-hmm.
Their retention, their fuzziness, or totally blank out their minds. My experience with hypnosis, when I was in college, I was doing a lot of hypnosis and age regression at that time. And we find out that the subconscious remembers everything, but it's a little irrational. So we can either lead it or it can lead us. So we have to find out what kind of record it's really playing. In other words, it could be skipping the grooves. The other information that you're talking about, whether you played the frequency out or not, probably does not have any bearing. It could be just an experience that happened merely because of the frequencies that you're generating are at the audio level, and we're looking at frequencies that may or may not be frequencies that you can hear. And you can't record it with a little portable tape recorder.
Well, you recorded them off of KABC, and you can't get anything over 10,000 cycles off this radio station, no matter how you try. If you do, then the FCC would be very unhappy with it.
Yeah, what does UMO mean, by the way?
Well, the UMO is another planet, UMMO, and they're just like the Pleiadians.
Ah.
And they just happen to be, they picked Spain, for instance, to be another contact. And they have been in contact with several people over there. And they contacted really funny over there. They wrote them all letters. And they all had a stamp. And it appears that after they got through writing letters, and I don't know who, dropped them in the postmark, but then they were in direct communication with a couple of people and very technical information.
I know the Azores, which is a Spanish island off in the Atlantic, seem to have a lot of UFO sightings. Do you know anything about that? Or it's supposed to be because it was once part of Atlantis.
I'm not familiar with those sightings indirectly because I've been working with other ones that are going on, but there seems to be no place that we're aware of that does not have sightings of people that allow themselves to have the sightings. It seems to be once you allow this to happen or raise your frequency of yourself, they appear.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Soviets are talking about rather openly now in their press UFO sightings. We have senators who are now talking about it, and ex-senators, they have seen them.
Well, it's real funny because I just went to Peking or Beijing this last year. And I brought over a couple of the copies of the UFO contact book, and we were to bring them to in Peking to let some people look at it. The guide, I mentioned that I wanted to make sure I got a copy of this to people in charge, and he just happened to be on the magazine that you can get on any stand on UFOs anywhere in China, because they're avidly in it. And we are currently having a book come out next week, which is UFOs Over China, which has about 500 and some pages of UFO sightings in China itself. So they're very much involved in it.
And you say you have 10 books right now that are out that are different cases. Can you tick them off for us here real fast?
Well, I don't have all the names of them right now. I think it would probably be easier for us to send a list of each one. Because each one of them goes into a different type of a species of contact that comes into them. For instance, a contact from the IARGA is one from people that are aquatic, so to speak. And they look like us. It seems genetically they all have two arms, two legs, and two eyes, and two ears, and this type of thing. But maybe the development of their planet was more aquatic, or maybe it was a different base. Like, we're based as a carbon base.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe theirs was a silicon base. But they still end up having this for mobility and what have you. And it appears that we have books and investigation in collaboration with Wendell Stevens. We've been trying to get his information out for what it's for the information.
Put it on the table and let you...
Let you read it out.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Edson, does that help you?
Thank you very much. And what was the address again in Colorado?
It's box 441335. And it's Aurora, Colorado, 80044.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, I'll be in contact with you. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.
Appreciate your call. You're on, Larry.
Oh, hello?
Yeah.
Oh, Bill?
Yes.
I listen to you on the news all the time. I just think you're great.
Thank you.
But I was going to tell you, I had a sighting about, I think it was in 1974. I was watching The Music Man, and I went over to go get a Coca-Cola at the store, and I happened to glance up, and there it was.
And
I just couldn't believe it. It came down like a shooting star.
Did you see the craft itself or just lights?
Well, it came down like a burning star, only it took a right angle. You know, like they always say, a right angle. It didn't stop. You know, it didn't burn out. It just shifted.
Yeah.
And I thought, dear God, that's a little bit strange.
Yeah, they are strange to see those things. And this was when, in 1944?
In about 1974.
Oh, just within the last 10 years or so here in L.A.?
Yeah. I just happened to go out the backyard, and I was going over to the store to get a Coke.
Hey, well, thank you for sharing that with us, Larry. We've had reports of a lot of people here in the Los Angeles area seeing them. I haven't been able to see one myself.
Well, I thought, I was talking to your girl that screens, mm-hmm. and she was telling me that she had a sighting off of... marine lamp.
Well, I'm going to have to put her on, too, and find out what that's about.
Well, you know, a lot of people are just, skittish about, coming out and saying, they've actually seen these things.
Well, get out of the closet.
But they are real.
Yeah, they are. Okay, thank you very much, Larry. Appreciate it very much.
Okay.
We'll be back. In just a moment, I'm Bill Jenkins.
Hello. How you doing tonight?
Doing great.
Well, it's the first time I've turned into your radio station. And I'm glad I did.
Where have you been, Richard?
Hiding out in Hollywood.
We've been here for 25 years doing this.
Well, I haven't been in town that long, I guess. Either that or I just like to remain ignorant. First off, I'd just like to say that your show is certainly breaking bold ground by airing this subject and a lot of other subjects. It sounds as if you've really put forth some amazing programming.
Thank you. We have. At least that's what people tell us. Except the program director. He looks at me funny every now and then, but it's still here and we're doing our thing.
Well, I'm going to listen from now on. Now, my question for Mr. Green is, what type of resistance has he run into through different government bureaus or agencies, things like that, the media in general? Why is it, or in your opinion, why does it seem that so many people are reluctant to advertise and publicize these events?
Actually, I've never run across anything that's been like that. When I was in the service, of course, I was assigned to a secret area, and I just was not allowed to talk about anything that I had for that area. Currently, I find that most people are not willing to talk about things because of their fear. The next thing that I find in all of this whole area of UFOs is the economics behind it. And economics are one of the big situations that keeps a lot of this information going out. It's great for some of the rags magazines that you're looking at, but for generally...
And open mind.
maybe for open mind, too, but look at the general people that are doing the investigations right now. The Center for UFO Studies in Phoenix, for instance, with Dr. Hynek, total income is $1,000 a month, and that pays the phone, the salaries of three people. And now that doesn't do anything. And we find out that the same is true with the rest of the organizations throughout the United States. And if you were to get involved with putting out the information, it's always the lack of capital. And that was the same problem with the Genesis Group when they first investigated the problem, was the lack of capital to get out, a very highly technical investigation of the information. They did the best they could. They got everybody going. And they did do a good job for what they had available. And that's what we have to go on. At this point, there's no mass amount of money available, let's say, from the private sector or public sector, either one, or section, that will allow some investigations. And everybody says, yeah, well, I'd like to know more about it. It really doesn't do too much. We find out that the people are curious, but will you put your money there?
Well, I've always maintained since been doing this show, Richard, for many years now, that the time is long past for the so-called UFO groups. This is just absolutely the wrong thing to do. But we do have something that is going on that is of enormous importance. And really, the vehicle that should be done is major media.
Mm-hmm.
It was very disappointing, for instance, a year ago last summer when the Brewster incident happened. I don't know if you're familiar with Brewster, but for many nights during the summer, these lights kept coming over the area at night. This is in upper New York State.
Mm-hmm.
Thousands of people saw them. Tens of thousands of people saw them. They had mass meetings up there. Television networks even sent cameras up there. ABC did broadcast pictures of them on a couple of their newscasts. But it's amazing how, as fascinating as that story would be, and how obviously these giant lights in the sky that were structured perfectly, it couldn't be anything else, not even little airplanes flying around at night trying to hoax the folks. And the studies that went on, nobody really raised the flag. ABC, NBC, CBS, the legitimate news agencies that could have done something very big with this, that could have gotten into an investigation, find out what the government was saying, they weren't saying anything, although they were certainly out there looking. Why? And this is not the first time it happened. It's the second time it's happened. It'll probably happen again up at Bristol.
Is it possible that it's backlash from Orson Welles' War of the Worlds?
I have a hard time buying that.
Well, when it was broadcast, people panicked. Well,
that was in 1938, and people were a lot older than that. I think in the beginning, perhaps, that we had to deal with the War of the Worlds syndrome, but that was the only data that those in government had to deal with. If we tell the people about the flying saucers, what we really know, and this goes back into the time of Harry Truman, the only data they had was that there might have been mass hysteria.
Right.
But I have a great deal more confidence in the people of the United States in that. I don't think you'd get hysterical if you found out that there indeed were extraterrestrials flying around over our city, would you?
Well, apparently people are saying there are, and I'm not in much of an uproar about it, I don't think. But it's more of just a curiosity. I would welcome the opportunity to see it firsthand. Another question I have for Mr. Green is that oftentimes the photographs we see as the public in books and things are very sketchy, very unclear, not precise photographs. And knowing optics and things nowadays, I don't understand. Have you yourself seen clear photographs? Is the public, do we have access to things that don't seem fraudulent? You know, the photographs look, yeah, that looks real. It doesn't look like a frisbee out of focus.
The contact book that we have called UFO Contact from the Pleiades contains a tremendous amount of clear photographs. It's like as close as your automobile and very detailed. And again, you can order that from us.
And those photographs have been subjected to an enormous amount of testing to see if they are real. Even down to testing the emulsion layers, testing the shadows, the blur images on them, all kinds of things.
It was interesting that Billy's mission, again, was to give to the people the clearest and the most quantity of pictures that we have, and they actually posed the craft to allow him to take these pictures. Remember, Billy was a one-armed man.
Right.
So he had to set his camera and cameras in motion to take these pictures.
Mm-hmm.
And you'll find that some of them are blurred because they moved. And I have a collection of, say, 500 pictures.
Hmm.
And you can get videotapes of the moving pictures that were...
Oh, yeah, you can
available.
Get videos from Genesis of this particular case. And I, like I say, I have over 500 pictures of other ones.
Fabulous.
All right, Richard. Thank you for a good question.
Thank you very much.
I hope you stay with us now.
I will.
Now that you've found KABC, stay aboard.
Okay.
That's hour one of Open Mind tonight. We have 2 hours to go. Our guest is...
Well, primarily because they can walk among us. They don't look too much different than we do. And so they don't like that. But they did... when you're looking at Ascot, there's a couple other pictures that he does have available that you can get. The ones that were interesting to me are ones with Semyasi when she was holding... She has a laser gun in the picture, a couple of them.
Oh, yeah?
And Billy was playing around with the laser gun, shooting holes in the tree and shooting off limbs. And of course, we were sitting there looking at the tree that's right outside of his house with a perfectly round hole that... is burned on both sides. And right now it's, you know, a year, 2 years old, or 2 years old anyway. You can tell that we didn't do it.
Why are the pictures of them so rare, though?
Well, because they don't want to be seen walking down the street. If the picture got out and all of a sudden you recognize them, they didn't want to do that. At this point, they don't care because they're no. Semyonsi's not around anymore.
Yeah.
Since she's gone. The communication that Billy has right now is with Semyonsi's father, Quetzal.
Oh.
Ascot is not from Pleiades, either.
No, Ascot is from the Dal universe. The next universe over, and when Billy was taken to the next universe, he was talking about like a cell, a circular cell. He got like a bump going into the next universe, and that's where the Dals were.
Mm-hmm.
What kind of life exists in the Dal universe? Do we know much about it?
Well, not only what Billy says back again, that they have advanced again farther and farther ahead than we do. For instance, let's go to the Pleiadians. The Pleiadians tell us that they have three planets that they live on in that system.
Mm-hmm.
And there's about 25 billion of them, which is quite a few. And they're out going through the system, checking on all kinds of life in different areas. They even took Billy to a planet that was prehistoric times like us.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the reason why they carried this laser weapon we're talking about, as a defensive weapon, not as an offensive weapon. And just to protect themselves as they make their skirmishes, because they may be eaten alive or something on these expeditions that they take off on.
I imagine they carry that if they walk around on planet Earth. A great deal. But you've got volume one, volume two. That's a good start on the pictures that come from Billy Meyer. He has others that you can get from him. You have that address over at the tip of your tongue there, George?
It's you can write to Billy Meyer direct at 8466 Hinter, HINTERSCHMIDRUTI. That's Hinter Schmidt-Rudy. And it's ZH, which stands for Zurich, Switzerland. And if you do write to him, send him a couple dollars, because they don't have any money, and they'll have to, pay the stamps and everything else, and they'll send you a list of the pictures that are available.
All right, well, thanks a lot.
And be patient, because the mail is slow between here and Switzerland.
There's about three people over there that will translate the English to German, and then Billy will read them, and then they translate it back to English and send you back the information. But you can get it, and you will get the information.
All right, well, thanks a lot.
All right, John, thank you very much. And we have Ernie on the line. Hi.
Hi. Listen, I was wondering what the chances are of becoming or being a discrete contact, and how you can improve the likelihood. So I'm moving up to the Table Mountain area in Northern California, which is a perfect place for that kind of a contact.
They contact the people they want to contact. I think it's a question then of letting your mind be open to that. Open and receptive to that.
Yeah, well, I meditate with my crystal cluster and trying to project out my interest and intent. And I don't know if that's a practical thing to do, to make such contact, but I try.
You know, that's a very strange thing. It's hard for us to know just exactly what their criteria is. They don't think the way we do at all. And we're not about to shape the way they think. And the people they contact, they're... I would suspect, and I believe somewhere along the way, Wendell told me of people that they studied for a long time, vertically, over a period of years, and determining whether this would be someone that, A, they could communicate with, and if he had the probability of being able to get the word out.
Some they just go and take, and they'll go ahead and do the observation. I think it... This time we have Wendell going to come in, and I think we should have Wendell come on and talk to us all, too.
Wendell?
Yes, sir. How you doing, Bill?
Wendell Stevens, welcome back to Open Mind. It's good to hear your voice.
Nice to be with you again.
Ernie just put a question to us, Wendell, and I don't know of anyone who can answer it better than you can.
All right.
He's going to move up into a remote area in the tabletop country, and what can he do to improve his chances of being a contact?
Well, I don't know of anybody who has set out to be a contact that became one.
it seems
like they have another way of selecting, and what I'm finding in a number of contactee cases is that there is some relationship from past history with the contactee, and it's difficult to know what that is until the contact is open.
How about going through an introgression?
I'm not sure how you would identify whether you were going to be one or not. I just don't know how you open one.
I think, Ernie, the best trick is to forget it.
Yeah.
And if it's going to happen, it'll happen.
Yeah.
Have good thoughts and be open for the idea, but carry on.
Well, that's certainly
yeah, you can be receptive, and maybe it will happen, but I don't know of any case where one has set out to do that and accomplished it.
Well, thank you for your time.
Yes, sir. See you again.
Okay, bye-bye.
Yes, sir.
Wendell,
yeah.
Your research is continuing to go on at full speed. What are some startling things you have for us?
Well, some interesting things have come to my attention in the last few years here. There are other Pleiadian contacts going on. And the most interesting thing is they started all about the same time. The contacts going on in Bogota, Colombia, even today, started in 1973. They reached a kind of a peak in frequency in about 1977 and 78, which kind of course coincides with the things that were happening in Switzerland. There's another set of contacts going on down near Acaya, Peru, that began in July of 1974. And of course, you know, the Pleiadian contacts in Switzerland began in January of 1975. Those reached a crescendo of contact activity about 1977 and 78. There's another set of contacts going on the north coast of Venezuela at Tocuyo. Those began in mid-1975, just a little bit after the contacts in Switzerland, and they reached a peak in about 1979. All of these are still going on a limited basis. All of them are mentioning similar philosophies. They all say that they come from the Pleiades. They all are humans, just like we are. They all claim some relationship with our past history. There's a lot of similarities here, and there's no evidence that any of these contactees were aware of any of the others at the time these things were going on. Of course, now they are aware.
Do they all come from the planet Earth or some of the other...
No, they all come from different parts of the Pleiades.
Mm-hmm.
And they all do mention that there are other inhabited planets in the Pleiades, and that what we see of the Pleiades is an oversimplified view of a very complex system of astral bodies.
Is there any reason why Earth seems to be of such great interest to the different societies that
exist in Earth? The human creatures coming here from other planets seem to have some past relationship with Earth humans. And there seems to have been a variety of visitations here in the ancient past history several times over, leaving survivors after they left each time, usually in a cataclysmic change. And they seem to be coming back to those. Now, all of those that are coming here have been here before, in other times in the past, and probably will be back again in the future.
To bring us a little more up to date, I understand from your daughter, Cece, that there was another flap over Tucson yesterday.
I haven't heard anything of that. That's a good one on me.
She hadn't communicated with you yet, but
no.
We were going to try to get her on, and she was going to do some investigative work.
Oh, okay.
A number of people saw it, about 60 of them.
I'm anxious to find out what that is now.
Because it's evidently quite similar to the event of a couple of months ago. What happened then?
A couple of months ago, we had four formations of 15 craft that flew over town. They were circular vehicles with a large white light at the bottom. The helicopter pilot, a police helicopter, got up close enough to see structure form behind the light, but he couldn't catch up to them. They were faster than his airplane.
Yeah, particularly if he was in a helicopter, but I understand thousands of people in Tucson saw them.
Yes, that was the word we had, that there were literally thousands that observed them in the four flights that passed over, about 15 each.
Now, you would think that would be a major story all over the country, wouldn't
it? Well, I think these things are suppressed, Bill. It was a major story here for one day, and then the police helicopter pilot was warned not to discuss it. The newspapers didn't report any more on it. The radar station at the military air base here tracked them. They never did identify them. Their tape was confiscated by Washington and flown away. They were told not to discuss them. A lot of activity took place and nothing got in the media.
Except here and in Tucson.
Yes.
And I think a little bit up in Phoenix.
Yes. There was also a sighting out there in Burbank in your area. I think it was either the next night or the following night, a similar sighting.
In about the time, right?
Yeah.
But you didn't hear anything about that in Los Angeles?
No, we didn't hear anything about that in Tucson here, and we never would have if it hadn't been one of the observers was known to us, and he called and reported it to Cece. She can tell you about that. In fact, you might be able to hook the man on tonight if you get a hold of Cece.
Okay. We're going to try to do something with Cece a little bit later on, but we were quite anxious to talk to you.
Okay.
And let you share your information with our audience. We have Ron on the line.
Oh, hey, great.
All right, Ron.
Hey, Bill. Hi, Mr. Green, Wendell.
See, there's another new thing. Well, it's not so new anymore. The latest trend in contactee cases seems to be a pattern of genetic experimentation. And basically, this is taking place in Brazil, but it's happening in all countries. It just seems to be we're getting more information out of Brazil. One of the cases down there resulted in a hybrid female child that is now 5 years old and being brought back to visit her father, her Earth father. And this is only a culmination of several years of prior experimentation in several areas that we don't know the results of.
Interbreeding going on?
In some cases it's direct, and in some cases it's done artificially under laboratory conditions. But in one case, they told the witness that they had successfully produced 81 hybrid creatures with Earth parents. In this case, we're aware of one living one that is healthy and growing well. There are a number of other cases where no progress was reported to the witness.
Okay, Ron, what was your question for Wendell or George Green?
Bill, I was getting back to the Tucson sightings and in general all sightings. Mr. Green had mentioned earlier in the show that they have the power to control their mind not to see, say, their station out in Tucson. But why would they let us see them flying over the city when they leave or coming in?
Asking is to speculate on how they think, and I don't know why they would allow themselves to be seen. I'm quite sure that they can easily overfly the city and never be seen.
Right. And take photos, but you can't see the ships on the ground, but... And I have sighted them myself years ago, but I was curious about that.
Well, it is puzzling because all the ships in the formation were seen, and that's a sizable formation, 15 ships.
But if they land in the desert, you can't see them, right? If they can control their mind not to see the station.
Don't know of any case that they landed here recently. I investigated a case several years ago where one landed near a farmhouse southwest of town here. The farmer shot at it with a 30-30 rifle from fairly close range. It flew a little ways, then landed in the desert, dust roiled up around it, beacons flashed, and then it took off and flew away again. But there were a number of witnesses at the ranch. There was at least 15 witnesses to that. That's the only one I know of here that landed on the ground.
Yeah, I was curious because if they have that power, why do they let themselves be seen at times and not others?
Well, there has to be a reason for that, because in most cases, I would say that they have control of the visibility.
Right.
But okay. Well, you know, they're people, too. Someone may have forgot to flip a switch.
Right.
All right, Ron.
Thank
you.
Thanks, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
See you, Ron.
Darren.
Hi.
You're on.
Hi. I have a couple of questions for you. I just turned on the radio tonight, and I heard this, and I have never heard any of this stuff before. I mean, I believe that there's life in out there someplace. What I'm curious about is, why do you think Washington or the Air Force or whoever doesn't allow the media to report these events like on a national level instead of locally, where it's treated like it's some kind of a joke or mass hysteria or something like that?
I want you to rephrase that. It's not that Washington doesn't, has control over the media saying you can't do this.
Right.
The control comes in getting valid information that media would feel comfortable with handling. Now, as to why that happens, Wendell, you were into that more than any of us.
I'd have to agree with you. They don't order it not to be reported. They just kind of discourage reporting by withholding facts.
Mm-hmm.
The facts that they have, which is always more than the facts that we have.
Well,
I suspect that it has something to do with our own research projects and trying not to discourage attention and speculation on what we might be trying to do.
Mm-hmm. Well, I have a question. And does most of the information that we receive on these people come from basically through private citizens, or is there any like organizations that are in contact with them that they contact? Or
yes, I would say that almost all of the information that you hear publicly comes from private individuals that got into the hands of a media reporter who did what he could with it, with the facts available, never enough to really support anything.
Mm-hmm.
And with no government support, and usually with discouraging responses to any questions asked.
So there is, like you were saying, there's no money, no tax dollars, no anything that goes into a fund to investigate this stuff through, I don't know, NASA or whatever?
Well,
like
I'm sure that the government has a number of highly classified research projects going, but they're classified at levels that the public is not going to hear about.
I think it's pretty well established, Wendell, through the Freedom of Information documentation that we have seen, and Karen, for your information, that the taxpayer does spend hundreds of millions of dollars on investigating the UFO.
I would think so.
And unfortunately, we, the taxpayers, are not privy to the information that we're paying for.
Well, a lot of times, too, you're mentioning, I believe somebody was mentioned about Edwards Air Force Base. A lot of times, too, they don't even tell. I mean, my cousin was at Edwards Air Force Base for years, and he never knew anything about any kind of UFO aircraft there or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
So I just was just really amazed when I was listening to this. What was the P.O. box where I can get more information on this? It was in Aurora, Colorado?
Yeah, 441-335.
Okay.
All right, Karen.
Thank you very
much. Well, I'm glad you tumbled in on us and stick with us tonight, will you?
Okay.
All right, I'm Bill Jenkins. We're talking about the reality of the UFO and the extraterrestrial on Open Mind, and we have on the line from Tucson, Arizona, Lieutenant Colonel Wendell Stevens, who is one of the finest investigators trying to get the wheat from the chaff in these cases all over the world. We have in our studio George Green, a businessman and a very successful one, who donates a lot of his time and his wealth, too, in tracking down and getting the truth about the UFO and getting it into your hands. And we'll try to get more of that truth into your hands in just a moment. Bill Stevens, one of the leading UFO investigators in the world, and with us in the studio, George Green, who is deeply involved in this kind of investigation and getting the information out simply for your perusal. You can look at it and take it or leave it, which is much of what we do on this show, George. And we are open to questions about the extraterrestrial, the contact cases that are going on, and whatever may be on your mind. Neil, welcome aboard.
My question is on the spaceships themselves and the extraterrestrials.
Mm-hmm.
How can they conquer the great distances of space and achieve the speeds that they do without going into light speed or whatever and disintegrating?
Well, you mustn't put things on the level that we understand it here. I think their physics are far beyond. But Wendell, I know, has some good answers for you on that one. Wendell?
Well, yes. In close to 100 cases I've examined, I don't know of any of them that come here in a linear sense, in the sense that we think of traveling from point to point at the speed of light. None of them would have made it. All of them seem to have some shortcut in traveling space, using some kind of different space-time relationship or space-time condition, and also possibly some different kind of time. They all make it in a matter of hours or weeks at the most.
We have talked, Neil, I don't know how much you've listened to the show, but we've had Colonel Bearden on from time to time, who is really an advanced theoretical physicist, talking about the ability that we're now being able to perceive in our physics of what he refers to as bending space-time. And perhaps this is what's happening there.
Okay.
Thanks a lot. Okay. Good to have you aboard. And Al, what's on?
Hi.
Yes.
This is for any of you. I have heard various things about the Billy Meyer case, not all of them positive, and I've heard this from other UFO investigators, and I'm just wondering, like, I've heard things about them finding UFO models in his trash and things like that. Can you comment on that at all? Any of you?
Yes, I'd be glad to, sir. There were models photographed, as in almost every case where photographs are taken. Early on, the photographer tries to model the spacecraft. He first draws it, then if he tries to model it. In the case in Switzerland, that was impossible because the man was not a model builder. He only had one arm.
Uh-huh.
So the models were usually made by other people. Most frequently, the sons of other people that were visiting there that made them, either turned them out of lathe, made them out of paper, or one thing and another. And all of those were photographed, too.
Mm.
But those were never offered to anybody as photographs of the spacecraft. That's a popular ploy used by the detractors to try to show that all the photographs taken were made of models, which is not true.
I think in one case, Wendell, didn't the Pleiadians give him a model of one of their craft?
Yes, that's right. In one case, the Pleiadians brought him a model of theirs and let him photograph it.
Huh.
And wouldn't it, and it was very interesting how whenever they analyzed the pictures of the models that they found also
like
in the trash, they found out that they were pictures of models. That's sort of the genius for the obvious, I thought.
Hmm. Okay, and I have one other question. These hybrids, so-called, is there any... Has they done much research with these persons to see if, like, they're more intelligent or, DNA differences and things like that?
Well, they seem to be advanced in a number of ways, both spiritually, physiologically, and they certainly had knowledge far beyond anything we could imagine.
You mean the hybrids? The hybrids, apparently it is only, 5 years old or something like that?
Yeah, Wendell, he's talking about the children. Have we seen any great...
The hybrid child down there?
Yes.
There's been no measure of the intelligence balances of the child. We have not been able to examine her. She was only brought to visit the father in a contactee situation twice. He's been taken elsewhere to another planetary base to visit with her three other times. He's been taken away four other times to the other operating base when she wasn't there.
Oh.
But it would be, it's a good question, Al. It would be interesting to see if this intermingling of these two different species will work and if it does bring on some advancement of the species.
It'd be interesting anyway. Okay, well, thank you.
All right, Al. Thank you very much for that. You're on, Ken.
Okay. Hi.
Yes.
Oh, Happy New Year. Yeah. Happy New Chinese New Year.
Okay. collect your getting geared. You're on the air.
Yeah, I was just putting my cassette tape in.
Okay.
Then I got to turn my radio off. Okay. Okay, I wanted to talk to Mr. Green and you, Bill,
okay,
about an experience I had a couple weeks ago, being that I am a contactee and I'm in touch with these beings from the etheric planes of Venus. And what happened, we were up in the mountains, and through my father, we talked to one of these beings, and I asked them if it was possible that, I hadn't talked to them for a few years, and I asked if it was possible that they still manifest in the material plane, their space brothers that work with them. And they said only if they feel a real need to. What was interesting, though, is that they mentioned that they are working and observing the innermost levels of our military and government, and they kind of play games with them. Before I get into, in a second here, about these kind of games, I wanted to mention that I found it real interesting that you were talking about how one can become a contactee earlier, and that is through opening yourself to that vibration, more or less, correct?
True.
Okay, and I would like to suggest the best method I know of for that is by developing a practice of meditation. Whatever kind of meditation one wants to get into, just practice meditation, and this kind of thing will happen. It will unfold at its own progress within every individual being, if it's supposed to.
If it's supposed to, that's the thing.
Yeah. Okay. And this has happened with me in my lifetime. My parents were both mediums, channels for these higher beings. And so they told us that, yes, they do sometimes materialize into the physical plane, because these beings that we communicate with dwell more in the etheric plane around Venus. But the beings that they call scientists are who we see in the physical plane here around Earth, and they say if they need to, they'll manifest. Well, on the way down from the mountains that evening, a few Sundays ago, January 19th, they did indeed materialize, and there was about eight of them, and they were coming through me and my friend. We were acting as channels, in a sense, and as their energy came through us and our voices, and as our voices would increase in intensity, the lights their lights of the spacecraft would grow brighter at the same time in complete synchronicity. And what was incredible was that five of these lights were in a pattern over March Air Force Base. And I wanted to hear what maybe Mr. Green could comment on this.
All right, but George, you have any comments about the etheric level of Venus?
I've been investigating a couple of cases on this case. In fact, Wendell sent me on one case to talk to the people. It's a little hard to get subjective evidence on etheric fields at this point. I have just talked to a couple of people that supposedly from Venus and appears that have some kind of imagination at that point. I'm not saying that it could or could not happen. The Pleiadians say Venus is not an original planet from here, from our system. But it's beyond us in this dimension that we're playing with in order to have some real critical facts. I think Wendell could back that up.
Now, Wendell, I know that you have looked into that level of contactee. What have you found out?
Well, I find what the man is describing there, what your friend is very much what Sheila describes also, the one who claims she was brought here from Venus when she was a child.
Yes.
And the light wave in a higher vibrational realm of being, but not so far that they can't densify it into ours, is also described. And much of what else he says, also she corroborates, or he corroborates her in one sense or another. Say, I've got a good one for you here, though. Another case in Brazil, another one of the abduction cases. Well, you got George on there.
Right.
There was a man that was picked up and taken to another planet again. This is from Botucatu. And that man was a hospital orderly in a city clinic there. And they had a terminal case that he was working on, and on an impulse, when he was aboard the spacecraft one time, he asked if they could help him with the case. And they picked it up from his mind immediately what he was, the case that he had in mind, and they gave him two samples of material, one to be rubbed on the soles of the feet of the man, and I don't remember what the other one was for. But we got specimens of each of those two samples and brought them up here to the United States, and George had them analyzed and found that the materials were quite unique. So you might ask George to fill you in a little bit on that.
They already did.
That was an interesting case. And by the way, the man who was investigating that was sideswiped by a car. His car was knocked off the road and killed. And on the photographs of the markings on the man's body and a number of other things that we definitely wanted disappeared when the wreck was recovered.
I went into that before you come on the air, Wendell.
Yeah, we had gone through that, and it's a fascinating story, and the compound had some things in it that they just couldn't trace down at the laboratory up there in Denver.
Yes.
All right, Ken.
Can I say one more thing?
You sure can.
Okay, this experience I was describing took place over over a half an hour period of time. And therefore, it wasn't just a momentary experience. So some way they must have been able to keep the Air Force interceptor jets on the ground, because it lasted quite a while, this communication, and which turned out to be a healing experience for myself also.
What kind of healing? A physical healing?
Physical healing, yes. I was healed tremendously from it. And so I was going to say that I derived from the experience that we really don't have too much to worry about any nuclear weapons, because if they can show that they're in control of the military, they're showing that the Creator, Godhead, Spirit, whatever you name it, is in control. We don't have to worry about nuclear weapons from the American government, Russian government, terrorists, anything like that.
Makes you wonder why they don't get this information on to Mr. Gorbachev and Mr. Reagan, doesn't it?
Well, I think we're in the process of doing that.
All right.
Bill, I'm going to have to leave you here. I want to tell you goodbye to you, Bill, and to George and Desiree there, and all your listening audience, and maybe we can do this again sometime.
Well, Wendell, it's a pleasure to have you here, and John and Karen Erickson are just dropped in and said to give you their love and hello.
Hey, bless your hearts, yeah. There's some very interesting things developing along that project that John was working on many years ago,
And if I can find his address here, I'll write him and tell him about it.
All right. Well, I'll write Lee and I'll make sure he gets it.
All right.
And we will try to get you back on as soon as possible. And thank you very much for taking time out. I know it was difficult for you to join us.
All right.
And
bye-bye.
Thanks, Wendell.
Yes, sir. See you.
All right.
Yeah.
Wendell was the very first guest I had on the Open Mind show, so he's always occupies a very special place in my mind and thoughts, and the work that he has done in trying to get this information out. The reality of the UFO is legion, and we'll be discussing it more now with George Green in just a moment. And discussion with us is George Green, a businessman from Denver, Colorado, many interests here in the Los Angeles area, all over the world, in fact, but he has a great interest in bringing the truth of this to your attention, and has involved himself deeply in that, has a number of books available for you, and he's certainly not in the publishing business. This is just a love of his, for you to get this information, take it in, accept it or reject it, but at least get some good information rather than some goof-off stuff or some wild mystical stuff that goes on. George, it's good to have you here. We have David on the line. Hi, David.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Yes, to follow up, it's fascinating. I have a question, Mr. Green. With regards to contact, that Ken discussed a few minutes ago, who are they? Who are you referring to, Mr. Green? Who are they? How do you communicate with them? It's most fascinating.
Each different contact communicates just like you and I are talking, or telepathically. So it depends on where they're at and what level that they want to go for their communication.
What language?
The Palladians go into their schooling, per se, and they say they, like going to Berlitz school, they spend a month learning whatever language they want to, whether it's German, English, Spanish, Lithuanian, or whatever. Then they come down and they interact and practice just like anybody else. And they can, in speaking just like you and I do.
Now, any physical form?
The Palladians look exactly like we do. They have a couple minor items, but their answer to that is there's no two people exactly alike in the whole universe that we know of right now, so they could be slightly different, but they claim that we're descendants of it, that this planet, I think the word that they used was engineered, and each of the different species or different races that we have come from different planets. They claim that the Palladians was one race, the Reticula Starcruster had another race, and each different race originally came from some different planet, and they basically evolved. We did have evolution as such, an intermixing between the races, and they told us about what had happened at Easter Island, for instance. That was a race of people that were basically giants.
When you refer to they...
That I'm referring to the 2,000 pages of notes that we have from the Palladians and discussing that, since primarily I'm on that. But each different book that we're working with, and working with Wendell Stevens in his investigations, each different contact, for instance, the people from the Reticula or the people from Iarga, whichever ace we're working on, gives us a different clue on all the different civilization of what's going on.
The sightings, for example, that are occurring in Tucson, what's the reason the press is not reporting it more extensively?
Well,
in your opinion?
My opinion is that it's not that newsworthy for them, and they cannot have any more valid information. In other words, great, there's a sighting. What can the Air Force do about it? What can they, anybody, the military do about it? There's a sighting. They're not capturing one. They're not doing anything at this point on it. They're there. And if they can't dissect it, then the people just generally don't put it away. Further back to this story you're talking about previously, Bill, I was at Dr. Hynek's, and we looked at a videotape from three different television stations in New York, on this case, on this flying V formation, and three independent television stations had their cameramen out taking all of these pictures, and these craft were as big as football fields, and twice as big as football fields that were going across. And now they have them, and all that they did hit the New York area for a while, but you didn't hear about it in the rest of the country, because again, you can't dissect it.
Mr. Green, for example, there was a sighting in Tucson, and you mentioned that about 1,000 people saw it. It's the most fascinating thing. Wouldn't it be an item that any newspaper would like to print and tell the people about? It was exciting in Tucson.
You would think so.
Yes,
David.
Exactly.
But, what George is trying to point out to the safe, you're an editor on the desk of the Los Angeles Times or at Channel 7.
Mm-hmm.
The story is that there was a sighting.
That's it.
And thousands of people saw this formation of disc-shaped craft fly over Tucson. That is the end of the story.
Yeah, what evidence do we have?
Don't
even
know.
If you have a photograph, generally they're black and white, and just occasionally.
Now, at the same time, a story comes in about a five-car crash on the freeway and six people were killed.
I understand.
And so there goes this story.
There goes this story. Can you accept that, Mr. Jenkins, that the story...
Well, I don't think that that's good journalism, but... And I wouldn't do that, and I don't do that. When I sit on the desk here at KABC, I did report the Tucson story. I was probably the only one that did.
I see.
Because I think it's important. It's true. I don't know where they came from, where they were going, but I do know some things about it. Thousands of people saw it. The military saw it. And as you heard Wendell say, that the tapes from the military bases were whisked away to Washington.
Yes.
That's also a part of it.
Which brings me to my next question.
Yes.
This has been going on, this phenomenon, for about 40 years, I suppose.
Well, since the beginning of time.
Beg your pardon?
Since the beginning of Earth history.
Okay, then it's 45 years, 46 years. All right. What's the reason for our government, and I presume, Mr. Green, you say that probably the Soviets or the British or the French, the Chinese, are also withholding this information from their people? What's the reason for it? And do other governments do the same thing?
I think that they do, but not in that greater detail. The Soviets have they have assigned a team in order to investigate it. The Chinese...
They would do it just because we're investigating it.
Well, except for they're making the information available. And
they are?
They are making the information.
To their people?
To their people.
Yes,
you can read it in Pravda?
You can go down to the corner newsstand and get a copy of Sputnik or some of the other Russian papers, and there is generally a story in there about a sighting, and this is a government-sanctioned newspaper. It's not like the National Enquirer.
But you're talking that their press, the Soviet press, whether it's Pravda or Izvestia, mm-hmm. that you find those items there in the paper?
Yes, you do.
And, okay, what's the reason for the government's withholding it? Our government, for example. And the Soviets not withholding it.
We've wondered about that. We have some, as Wendell touched upon, on the ideas. One of them is that concurrent with the, say, the national acceptance, with the government imprimatur upon the national acceptance, that we are being visited by people from other planets, is the fact that we also may have research going on, primarily from those craft that have crashed. And if we are openly researching crashed UFOs, and I think this is where the problem is as far as the government is concerned, that means that we are openly researching their propulsion systems, their navigational systems, perhaps their weapon systems, and that represents a technological
leg
up greater than the hydrogen bomb, which of course then starts politically interrupting or changing the balance of power and doing all sorts of things. So the government would rather that nobody knows that they even acknowledge that they exist.
When you say nobody knows, you mean... the public, doesn't know. But certainly, they know about it, and if they know about it, the Soviets know about it for sure.
That would be my rationale, David, but maybe I'm not very smart.
Okay. The incident that Ken described there, what happened to him on the 19th of January,
mm-hmm.
how does one take it? How does one hear? I was listening. It was fascinating. It's hard to believe. Still, Mr. Green, would you care to comment?
We get a lot of people that give us sightings, and the Pleiadians explain that they can block out areas so that you could see the ship and nobody else could. They put it in perspective. Let's say you're sitting on the corner of a building, or you're at one in the middle of a building, and there's a policeman on the corner, and then there's somebody else on the other side. You can see the policeman, and maybe the other person can see one side of the policeman. They block out certain areas. They actually, to make it simply, we took a flashlight and you put out a beam of light. They can put out a beam that cuts out and bends the waves so there isn't anything there. So they call it cloaking, simply.
Mr. Green, and finally, could you comment on my question when I asked Mr. Jenkins, gave me his reply, reason for the government withholding it, and is it our government specifically withholding it?
Well, I think every government has a secret, but Larry Fawcett, who I believe has been on the air before, has been doing an admirable job of
of getting the documentation released from the government through the Freedom of Information Act and has put out a book on it.
Yes, indeed. And in that book, a great deal has been time has been spent of the information that happened last year in the American base, which is adjacent to the RAF base in England. And some of the government secrecy here in the United States did not apply because it was an English base, and we were able to get a lot of the information of that sighting and landing into the public's hands.
It's one of the things that Wendell and I were discussing before, is that he can get all the information he wants to outside of the country, but it seems to be a lot of the information here that we get in the United States about, you know, sightings other than a few isolated has really been dismissed or hushed up in some ways.
Larry Fawcett's book called Clear Intent, by the way, is an excellent book.
Clear Intent?
Clear Intent is the name of it. I think you can get it at Alexander II, some of the many of the stores around. It gets into the government cover-up and perhaps some of the reasons for it and how that's being broken down by the Freedom of Information Act, the information that is coming from government documentation, which clearly states that there are UFOs, there are contacts, there are landings, there has been interference with military activity as well as political activity in the United States and in other nations as well. And this is all from government data, government documents, from the good old USA.
Wouldn't you wonder sometime, for example, if they're flying around an Air Force base, why they don't scramble?
They have on many occasions.
Yeah, they have several times. In fact, in New Mexico, I was down there last year on another case, and we were discussing it because we are right next to a base. It's where we do a lot of our missiles. And they have all their radar equipment set up, and they quit scrambling their bases because the saucers were going across so fast that the radar equipment just, you know, couldn't keep track of it. It just goes zip and air went across.
What are you going to do when you scramble?
Yeah, how are you going to intercept them? The craft that we have that are available are not able to attain that speed.
Well, maybe you want to invite them for tea. Maybe you can get them down this way.
If you were one of them, would you want to have tea with someone on a military base here?
No. I'm talking about invited to tea them. Anyway, well, thank you. Maybe you can get them together with Gorbachev and Reagan. Maybe you can do something.
I think those efforts have been made, in fact.
Really?
Yes.
Interesting. Okay, well, thank you.
All right, David, thank you.
Most fascinating.
Those were good ones.
Thank you.
All right, Jim, you're on.
Hello, Bill.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I talked to you a while back. I wanted to speak about the propulsion systems.
Ah, everybody does.
Yeah, I didn't hear anything really specific, and I thought I should call in and ask.
Well?
I'm very concerned about the Bill Myers incident. Was the type of craft similar to the Adamski sightings, where they had the three balls on the bottom?
The new craft have a number of balls on the bottom from Pleiades.
Oh, they do. I had received a subscription, magazine subscription, to a magazine entitled Energy Unlimited, and a while back, quite a while back.
Can you speak up just a little bit, Jim?
Yes. Okay, in the book, the magazines I received, they went into a complex dissertation about a type of energy called tachyon energy, which is not the same as the tachyon particle, the so-called faster-than-light particle. It was a word coined from the word ion, similar to the ion propulsion,
mm-hmm.
except that the energy was tacked in a three-phase oscillation.
Mm-hmm.
And this was to warp space-time, supposedly the purpose of this. And it was also claimed
space-time, that... You're talking about warping space-time?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Similar to the
dilatation. It would be almost instantly that way.
Yes, like just actually... joining the point A to point B. And
holding a piece of paper corner to corner.
Yes, exactly.
I'm going to tell you what, our hour has come to an end, but I would like for you to stay on, if you will.
Thank you.
Because we're going to take a break for the news at 11 o'clock from ABC in New York, and then we'll get right back with Jim, who's asking a question you had learned in your reading, Jim. Let's recap that again, and then perhaps we can take it further with the information that we have.
Okay, Bill, thank you. I've been studying quite a number of books. Some of the most fascinating to me and the most in-depth with really good principles involved have been the books written by a man named Bruce Cathy. of New Zealand, who used to be an airlines pilot.
Yes, he was. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if perhaps George Green has read any of those books to deal with the harmonic locations or power spots around an energy field that we're all surrounded in, like a matrix.
Yes, an energy grid that exists all over the world, I think, right. Kenny talked about. Yeah, this is John Bedini. John,
I've read a little bit about that. Let me just tell you what comes to my mind as I was sitting here thinking. Let me tell you some of the things that I've written down here.
Okay.
Something pulled me to the radio station tonight, and it probably was to give me some sort of information into this. I'm going to give you a few keys. The shapes of crystals, it's a very important point. The sound and frequency and the correct color. Now, this is the way that I translated it, as if a light bulb turned on inside my head.
Mm-hmm. This happens to be
This is crude. Hard. Combinations of energy waves to create 100% energy conversion. Light waves could be blue, white, frequencies low and high, varying in pitch. All right?
All right.
All a combination of what we're calling a change in space-time. Now, you know what happens if you beat two sound waves together, you get a third harmonic. You get a different frequency.
That's the... Yes, I do. That's...
All right. Possible cloaking device. A ray that changes our light spectrum into some other spectrum. Do you follow that?
Yes.
All right.
Sort of like the Philadelphia experiment?
Not quite.
No?
These would be frequencies much higher than we're used to dealing with. As you know, we can conceal sound by adding a frequency to the sound and transmit it somewhere, and the normal receiver will not pick it up. Now, you've heard of that, right?
Yes.
All right, so now when you go to capture this, you must generate a frequency, and then all of a sudden you pull the sound out, right?
Okay.
Almost as if it was a sideband, like a voltage-controlled oscillator or something. But the things that come to me is a three-dimensional formula with a zero starting point, A, B, and C. Now, you can change those A, Bs, and Cs any way you want to, but you could be at any one of those places in time in just a twinkling of an eye if you could bend the space-time just exactly right. And it has to do with the frequency, a crystal which would, some form of shape, which would capture the energy, and then the crystal itself would emit a power field, which you have to capture at another frequency, and you have to turn that into an electromagnetic energy, which we're all familiar with. That's what lights are lights.
About it, they told him about their propulsion system, and it seems very familiar to what John is talking about here.
It's exact. He's saying exactly what they're saying. We have to collect light and change it to an electromagnetic wave and frequency. And it appears that that's exactly what happens in the propulsion of their craft by the frequencies we can record. That's right. I just want everybody to know that this information, I never gave it a second thought. It just came to me here.
He was sitting there busily writing while we were busily talking.
But the idea here is to capture the energy which surrounds all of us. And we have to find some way to conveniently capture that by the use of some form other than fossil fuel, other than slaves pumping a water wheel. It's going to be either a mixture of crystals and certain tones and overtones and varying color and light.
And once we do this, we'll have enormous energy. But I just think that we have to be on a little bit different level spiritually and everything else to capture this energy.
Mr. Padini.
Yes.
Is there a P.O. box number I can write you at?
Yeah, it's Padini Electronics.
Yes.
P.O. Box 769, San Fernando, California, 91341.
94341.
91341.
Thank you. And I understand you work with Thomas Bearden?
Yes, I do.
You're familiar with everything in this book, The Excalibur Briefing?
And Beyond, yes.
Yeah, pretty familiar with everything. Well, I talk to Tom about twice a week.
The reason I ask is because I have a Neurophone.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And I was wondering if I could write to you more about that.
I think it would be best to talk to the expert, and that would be Patrick Flanagan.
He's
the
sort
inventor.
Of hard to get in touch with, I think.
I think you can write to him, and he'll answer.
Yeah, he will. He has a Novato, California address, and he's getting where he's not as busy and running around the world as he was, where he's answering his mail much better.
Oh.
He even answers his phone every now and then now, but... Yeah, you can reach Patrick, and certainly Patrick is the expert on the Neurophone.
Well, thank you very much.
He invented it. Did that help the question that you had, and did it seem to fall in line with the research that you had done on these propulsion systems, Jim?
Yes, it really does. I've always felt that the crystals, are an answer to a lot of our energy needs, and also to, zero time transport or instantaneous transference.
Nonlinear travel.
Yes.
All right, Jim.
Well, thank you.
Thank you for a good question. Good to have you aboard. We have Jay on the line. Hi, Jay.
Hi, how you doing?
Doing fine.
Good. Listen, I haven't been listening that long. I kind of turned it on about your station about a half hour ago.
Where you been?
Well, okay. It's been a slow night on TV, so I thought I'd listen to something since.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I have a question or two. Has anybody really seen the Billy Myers video cassette yet?
Yes, I have.
Okay. How much credibility do you really give it?
Well, I give it a lot of credibility. The tape was made actually by Yowie, who is a Japanese, he's the Japanese Steven Spielberg, I guess you would say.
Right.
He sent his film crew to Switzerland, and thorough and investigative work, I thought, in trying to present Billy Meier and the Billy Meier story. And in the tapes also you have a lot of the footage that Billy Meier took with his little movie camera. They put their television cameras on the screen in Billy Meier's house, and that's
right.
the pictures you're getting.
Mm-hmm. Because I've actually seen the tape.
Mm-hmm.
My neighbor has it,
mm-hmm.
And he showed it to me on New Year's Eve, and I used to work for a TV studio,
mm-hmm.
and I used to be an audio tech and camera tech, and observing the tape, there's too many cuts. I don't know if you've really taken a close look at it, but when you look at the foreground, where the spaceship was in a particular center screen, and then all of a sudden it vanishes, and it explains in the tape that it's in hyperspace where it takes off. To,
mm-hmm.
If you actually watch the foreground, there is trees. You always make sure there's trees or bushes somewhere. And the bushes are moving. And the tree has a limb in there that's moving pretty rapidly. And then all of a sudden, as soon as that spaceship or whatever that was supposed to be disappears, I mean, the split second, there's no movement in that tree. Zero. Which is an indication that somebody either spliced it or somebody just... You know, by taking a camera, whether video or movie camera, putting it on a tripod, you can shoot footage and then stop footage and remove anything out of that screen that you want, and then continue and make it look as if it disappeared.
And some of the cuts that are seen in there, it's explained in the film that... The person who developed the film for Billy Meier helped himself to little bits and pieces of the film along the way. And they point out in there where to be looking for those, where it happened. In one of the pictures where the ship dematerializes at one point, I think Billy Myers in the picture himself as he kind of walked up the road. And it's in one position and it appears in the other. If you get a good stop frame action, there's a very interesting thing happens there as the ship is dematerializing. At one point, it's beginning to materialize at another point on the tape, which you can't do cutting film.
Well, no, but I tell you, it's very interesting. I used to do a lot of this stuff years ago when we were experimenting with video. When I was in communications, radio, and television, we didn't really have video that much. This is back in the late 60s and in the early 70s. Video was just coming to effect. And we used a lot of 16mm and 35mm stuff.
Yeah, this was 8.
Yeah, but the thing of it is, what I'm trying to say is that by shooting against a screen, in other words, if you have, I could very simply go out with my camera, my Super 8, and take pictures of or footage of somebody out in the field, then and showing a lot of sky above me, or above that subject, developing it, shooting it back on a screen, on a regular Super 8 movie projector and screen,
mm-hmm.
then take a vid.
You're going to be affecting the waves that are there about the craft. And she's sitting there floating back and forth across the natural ground. So that's her pivoter point. And that's one of the other things that we do have a lot of pictures of all over the world. If you see it, a craft hovering and it's still, it seems to be next to a tree or something else that they can go ahead and ground the craft to keep it at a still position.
Well, it looks a little bit like a boat would, actually.
That's exactly what you're doing when you're having a grounding force. You've latched it onto something. It may be vibrating within the frequency they're using because they're setting it up, but that appears to be a better answer than saying I put my model up there, because I've been over there and Billy's not doing this.
Mm-hmm.
He has no. This is just information he's getting out. More astounding of this, part of the movie was filmed by somebody else besides Billy. There are other tapes of the same craft on 8mm film.
Why is it? If you know, my question is, why is it always an 8mm film? Why is it always a Instamatic camera? Why is it always something other than
good
quality equipment?
It's all spontaneous. They aren't sitting down there posing it, and here's Billy without any money. What was his economics again?
Well, now, wait a second. Who's making all the money then?
Nobody. Billy's not.
Somebody's got to be making that money. Those tapes are not cheap.
Pardon?
People are paying $60 or $70 or $80 or $100, as much as $100 for those tapes.
Well, that's for...
Now, you and I both know that a video cassette only costs an average of $7 to $8.
That's the business decision of Genesis to do, but they also spend a lot of time in doing the research, right?
Well,
and they spent some money doing over there, so you can't begrudge them from doing what they want. They
have
an economic goal. That's
what they
want. I believe
that a person should make a profit or should make money. I'm not, you know, but I'm saying for someone, the way it was brought to me, my neighbor said, this man is not making a dime. Why would he lie? Why would he go through all this? Somebody's got to be making money, and when there's profit to be made, if there's a chance to stretching it a little bit to the truth, you know.
Well, we had Lee Elders on, who has produced that tape, about 6 weeks ago. And he went into the economics about it. Genesis, or actually it was his other company, had spent a lot of money in the investigation of it, and sure, they needed to recoup some money.
Sure.
And so they are using this Nippon tape in order to do that. There are some rights involved where... But Billy Myers just doesn't get to anything.
Well, it's just that it's kind of far-fetched that, you know, the way it was brought forth to me and the way I understood it to be is that nobody was making any money and it was just being done to show, the realism.
I would say it's still something that's deeply in the red as far as the money that's been spent in investigating it.
I just look at it, it's a matter of economics. If you had a million people interested in it, the tape's price could be dropped down to, you know, substantially. I think that, again, it's an economic situation. And who pays for the research? I do my own. I don't ask for anybody. I just go do it. When we're asking... for somebody else that maybe does not have the wherewithal to go do it, where do they get their money? They either have to create something that you're talking about.
Sure, most definitely.
And the cost to do these things spread over a few items, 100 tapes, is a lot different than maybe 10,000, right?
Well, I just don't know how many people are actually buying them. I mean,
yeah,
I know that there's books out now. From what I understand, there's pictures of the Palladiums or something in it.
That's true. That's volume two, which we have available.
Okay, now, this is my biggest question. And this is, got to think about it for a second now. If all of this is coming down to the Palladians wanting people to know about them, then why is it, again, are we taking pictures with instamatic cameras and stuff, and why isn't this being, if they're allowed to be photographed with 35 millimeter or instamatic cameras or whatever it is, why aren't they being allowed to be put on film? Pictures of them actually moving, talking, and all that. That's a question I just don't understand.
That conjecture between all of us, they're basically observing us and seeing what's happening. Again, they're able to communicate with people that are a lot simpler in their, you know, mental abilities, per se, not digesting things. I'm not saying that Billy is ignorant. He's very street smart. It's just that he didn't have the economics to go out and buy himself a new video camera. And I don't remember too many people having video cameras 10 years ago anyway.
Well, they've been around for, since, actually on the market since 1972, 1973.
But they were very expensive.
They were very expensive, correct. But the fact still remains is you still had, back then I had 8mm Super 8 sound.
Well, your point being it would have been a lot nicer for him.
Even now, why aren't they coming around now?
It would have been a lot nicer for him to have approached a professional cameraman who had all of the latest.
Well, not even a professional. How about now? How about in the last 5 years?
Yeah.
Why haven't they come forth?
We're not sure that they haven't. When you're asking that question, we were... previously, when you're talking to Wendell Stevens and he was discussing our case in South America with the hybrid baby, we were closing in on the position where they were going to allow us to go down and have ABC film the liftoff.
And you and I were going to go?
That's right. We were going to go down. But unfortunately, we had a termination of somebody. He'd had an accident. And it didn't happen.
We were set to go, however.
We are working on another case that we may be allowed to do in Canada, as a matter of fact. And we're waiting now. It's supposed to be in the next few months. And we may be allowed to go do that. And when we are, and they're making the allowance, we aren't the one that's dictating the terms. They're telling us what's going on.
Well, I tell you, I wish you all the best of luck. I really do. I keep an open mind.
Good for you.
I'm skeptical. You know, I'm very skeptical. I look at this tape that my neighbor had with an open opinion, with skepticism.
There's another tape that follows that that deals with the rocket mineral samples and the alloy, and it features Dr. Marcel Vogel at that time at IBM, and he's one of the leading minds in the world about that, and you get a chance to look at those alloys with 2 million magnification, and he'll explain explicitly how that could not have been done on this planet.
Okay. Sounds good.
Okay.
Well, thank you very much for your...
All right, Jay, good question.
Thank you.
Good to have you aboard tonight. I'm Bill Jenkins. It's open.
Yes, hello, Bill and Mr. Green.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make a few statements, and then I'll get to my questions.
All right.
I've been researching and investigating the subject for over 30 years now, so it's taken up quite a bit of my time. In the early days, I'm going back to the early 50s, I was fortunate enough to meet a lot of the early day contactees. And I invariably found that the contactees themselves got some of the best photographs. Some of them took film. A large segment of the public is not aware of some of the film that some of these contactees took with 8 and 16 millimeter cameras. And it's quite good. Some of it even rivals some of the pictures that Billy Myers has taken. Some of the people who took this film were people like Dan Fry, Paul Villa. George Tamsky took a very good film in Mexico. I hope someday to get copies of some of this film and commit them to videotape. Then people can compare what they see in some of these films with what they see in the Myers film and with any new film that comes out. Now, my question is directed to Mr. Green, and I was wondering if he thinks whether our Air Force, our scientists, have gone far enough in their study of the propulsion systems to have developed and tested some of their own anti-gravity craft.
My estimation is that they are doing that right now. And they have been, and they've been experimenting with it. Colonel Stevens and I discussed a couple cases where we feel that some military officers have been flying the ET's craft and have blown themselves apart. Other information you're talking about, photographs, we're currently assembling photographs from all over the world and coming out with some new books with Colonel Stevens' help. So we hope to have four new volumes of strictly the photographic evidence that you're talking about. I have over 500 pictures from different sightings myself right now.
Mm-hmm. I think Wendell probably has one of the largest libraries.
He has probably the largest that I know.
Yes, I worked
in the early part of this century.
Mm-hmm. I worked a little bit with Wendell when I lived in Arizona, and I saw what he had.
So that's all underway, and most likely, but it is supposition, estimation, but there is no reason why our military shouldn't be dealing with this science or perhaps even the craft, because they certainly have some of them.
Well, there was a news article in the L.A. Times about a year ago of a general, Robert Bond, who was vice commander of the Air Force Systems Command, flying an experimental vehicle over Area 51 in Nevada that blew up, and he lost his life.
That's correct.
And there are rumors, I know, that Area 51 is a testing grounds for some of these experimental craft.
It's probably the most guarded point on the face of the planet.
Yeah, our information is that it was probably a craft from the Reticula. And, and the extraterrestrials were cooperating with him. And he had been doing numerous flights with it for the first phase of their transportation, which is in the Earth zone. And then he decided to flip the switch to go to the hyperdrive and blew himself apart. That was our understanding.
That's what I suspected.
Well, we've heard that. I've had that checked out as much as you can. You can't get too near Area 51. The investigation that I've done on it, that was certainly a story we looked into, but there is also a possibility there was a stealth craft that he went down in. So we're running both sides of that coin.
Yes, I've heard that too.
But he certainly did blow himself up. And there certainly is an Area 51.
Well, thank you very much, then.
All right, Bill. Thank you very much for your call. Good call.
Okay.
And congratulations on your work, and I hope you turn up the things you're looking for.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Ben, you're on.
Hi, Bill. It's Roy.
Uh-huh.
Hi, how are you? I have always been wondering this. If in the 2,000 pages of notes that you read or looked over, if the people from the Pleiades mentioned reincarnation, and if it is at all possible, if they talk about transmigration, if it's possible to go from, say, an Earth life to an extraterrestrial life.
They do mention reincarnation.
Mm-hmm.
They say it as a fact that we do go reincarnate. And we do travel from different planets, so it's quite possible that the quote word star people or whatever, that several of us are transplants from other places and vice versa. We're going to be migrating to other places for this experience that we have.
Mm-hmm. Because I know in the Iarga book, they mention that Earth is not open to their reincarnation selection, but which led me to believe that there is such a thing as reincarnation selection, and I was really interested in that, and if they had any criteria for the souls that they do select, or is it up to the individual? I mean, can you work on this kind of thing?
It's up to the self and your evolution and what you're going to be. It's not a question that we can make a decision. You're the one that makes the decision where you're at.
Mm-hmm. things being possible with God. And another thing I was wondering, did they talk about their way of life? Did they go into any kind of detail with that?
They described that they live pretty much like we do. They, you know, they mate for life. They have divorces very rarely.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's an exception. They kind of program each other to know each other a little closer. They live to be about 1,000 years of our Earth time. They say we're slaves to the bracelet. You know what I mean by that?
No.
We walk around with a watch on our hand, and that's what we do.
Yeah, time.
That's right. And we shouldn't be doing that. They go to school for 70 years, approximately.
Mm-hmm.
And they do things that they feel that they're naturally evolved towards. And if they do have children, it's very special, like one or two, whatever they have. And they go through the same training. They're very close on their population control. They're very selective on what they're doing. Like I say, they're inhabiting at least 3 planets with 25 billion of them. And they're, like I say, traveling through the universe.
Mm-hmm.
From what I have read of them, they are a very spiritual people. They spend time playing in the dirt a lot, working the ground. That keeps them rooted in the very basics of nature.
Mm.
A love-motivated society, as it were.
And, of course, they probably know no such thing as war, strife, famine. The things that we know on Earth.
They have a great experience with it, and it almost wiped them out. And I think that it's just the reaction to a society that once was very violent.
Mm-hmm. I see. Well, thanks very much, gentlemen.
All right, Dan.
It's been great. Have a nice night.
All right.
Mm-hmm. Bye-bye.
Greg, is that Gind?
Gino.
Hello, Bill. Glasses on here. It
only
looks like a D to me. Go ahead.
You have a nice show. I look forward to every Saturday. It's great.
Thank you.
Mr. Green, what did Air Force do with the craft at Edwards base?
I haven't the slightest idea.
Did they determine what kind of substance it was made of? Like maybe a crystal and metal substance, like the metal?
All that information was classified.
Still is, then.
Well, as far as I know, I don't even have any idea where the craft is at. I'm sure that they've moved it from Edwards.
Yeah.
For those who want to know just a little bit of background on that question, that maybe were not with us earlier in the show when talking about our guest tonight, George Green, when he was in the Air Force stationed at Edwards Air Force Base many years ago, he did indeed poke his head into a hangar that he probably wasn't supposed to and saw a flying saucer in there. And is talking about it.
Yeah.
And we thank you for that, George.
And also, George, have they incorporated the information that they found? Have they done anything with that to benefit us somehow, or use in their programs, space programs, or something like that?
Are you talking about our government now?
Yeah. Have we benefited from what we've found?
Doesn't appear that way. We just got you blowing some people up with a space launch.
Yeah, I know. So they, you don't know of anything.
No, the definition that we were discussing at that time was that the craft was iron-powered, would not work in this atmosphere, and that we were working on craft that would fly in the outer atmosphere. So I would expect that the engineering staff that was assigned up there was probably working and doing what they were doing. I was assigned to several secret projects up there that we were working on our craft. And I just happened to be out there at that time because I was at that time working with the X-15 project, and ended up there with a hangar with another craft out there. And I didn't think anything about it because we had a lot of strange birds.
Yeah. Do you think they're trying to simulate some of the materials out in space in the space shuttle somehow? Maybe experimenting, trying to come up with some kind of material that they've made the spacecrafts out of?
Again, the same problem that I have, you have been on earlier, is when we go for analysis of materials,
uh-huh.
We may be able to get close to what it is, but we aren't able to restructure the material at, with our current technology.
Uh-huh.
It appears that a lot of this is very simple, and as we talked with John Bedini and stuff, he's working on certain waves and waveforms right now that can actually change the molecular structure of metals and or materials, which may be close to what the ETs are telling us. And I, like I said, we have a lot of clues, but they're not giving us the complete schematic of how they put it together.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Well, I was just curious, and I thought maybe you could tell us.
Well, I hope we got you a little further down the road of your curiosity there, Gino.
Yeah. I'll just keep on going to Alexander too, and see what I can find over there.
Well, you'll find a lot.
Yeah, I've seen you over there. I finally know what you look like now.
All right.
That's great. So, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Gino. Appreciate you getting in here.
Bye bye.
How's it?
It's titled "The Secrets of Flying Saucer Propulsion" by Noel Huntley, and in it he describes a couple of experiments done by our people, and I'll just describe them briefly here. In other words, are we getting UFOs? This is what this is about. It says here, John Searle's flying disc, which appear to be a similar propulsion system to Carr's ideas, has achieved successful flight with large models for some time now. Newspaper articles have shown photographs of his saucers in flight over fields in Warwickshire, England. Searle's flying discs apparently do most things a real flying saucer can do. In 1950, he was experimenting with slip rings and built a segmented disc rotor. In 1952, it is reported that while testing a model using a generator for power, the disc broke its connections and rose to a height of about 50 feet and hovered, surrounded by a pink halo. This halo effect indicated ionization of the air at low pressure. It appears that the Searle effect involves the creation of a vortex which is tuned into the natural cosmic vortices of space, in particular the anti-gravity spiral, see chapter 13, which I did. And then here's another one. Townsend Brown, a brilliant American physicist, developed an electrogravitic system that resembled a true saucer propulsion. According to reports, discs 2 feet in diameter were made to fly around a central pole at about 12 miles per hour, and they were attached to this pole electrically and supplied with 50 kilovolts. And further development involved 3 feet discs energized by 150 kilovolts, and these were so impressive as to be highly classified. So, the impression I'm getting from that last phrase where it says highly classified, as soon as you figure out how to do it, then right away it's top secret.
That's true. In fact, one of my dear friends just became top secret this last week, and I don't know if we'll ever see him again.
Well, my impression has always been that the Russians and the Americans are in a race to get this technology. They each know something of what the other is doing, but they sure don't want to be beat. So I think it becomes highly classified, and it's no mystery to me that all the information disappears right away, because that would almost be like wartime, where things are highly classified, because suppose we could show up with a whole bunch of these over Nicaragua or someplace like these, we'd just carry the field right away.
Wouldn't it be better to use that technology for the benefit of man rather than the scaring of the pants off man?
Well, that's exactly it. Now, these higher-level people would want to do that, and my approach would be propaganda first. They're better at propaganda than we are. And the military, of course, wants to do it the old-fashioned way, the traditional Earth way, and they want this technology to do it with, of course.
Well, you can't blame them, and I'd rather them have it than the other guy. So, you know, there's always two sides of that coin. Do you have a question for George or John?
Yes.
I have a photograph of somebody in Brazil, which I don't know if it's authentic or not, and I just want them to comment. I'll try to describe what this ET looks like. It's supposed to be one who crash-landed there, and they befriended the natives and lived with them. And the head looks just like ours, except it's somewhat rounder. The eyes are very large and round. They seem to be more open than ours, and the ears are pointed. Do you have any idea what they look like? In other words, they got pointed ears like Mr. Spock on Star Trek, so I wondered if it was copied from that.
Do you have any idea how tall this individual is? That is the most common ET, I think, that we have seen in what we would call dire circumstances. They had problems with our radar, which would lock on and interfere with the operation of their craft, so they crashed the most. I think they corrected that problem. They thought it was a hostile action on our part, and wasn't. But the reticulans are the ones that whose bodies we have most of, and that we've been able to deal with most of.
Any word about the pointed ears?
That's a part of their makeup, yeah.
Oh. Okay, well, that was my question. Thank you very
okay,
much.
Okay, Boris. Thank you for that call.
Okay.
And we have Bob on the line. Hello, Bob.
Hello, gentlemen. I want to commend you on your efforts to educate us in a higher plane. I agree with everything you're saying, and at the risk of becoming top secret, I've been trying to explore the alternatives. I was very upset to see the Challenger blow its seams, but at the same time, I think it is a good learning experience for us.
If that's what happened, Bob.
Yeah, well, a great learning experience, especially for the young kids, because they are so accustomed to non-reality, and that really shocked them back to a situation. Also, our ego scientists, they're going to have to go back to the drawing board. And if they already don't know about anti-gravity or independent gravity, it's as simple as what the other gentleman was saying. I think his name is John. He was talking about using 100% of this energy, free energy around us, and it's really radiation on a lower vibration, what we would call ultraviolet. And when it's applied in a vortex with opposite. Would be, you know, opposite and equal forces being clockwise and counterclockwise. You get a common center. It radiates from a common center out in every direction. It's just like two magnets. You put them together, and they're trying to repel each other. Well, that energy breaks down into different dimensions, and what happens is the whole craft itself is vibrating at such a high rate of speed, it nullifies any kind of let's say common vibrations of mass that's relating to a planet. So this is why they appear to be different colors, because they're actually going through different levels of independent velocity or vibrations. And this is, I think, will interest Mr. Green. The reason I know about this is because I've been reading a lot of books, but I have a photograph that was taken by a friend of my father's out in the desert near Edwards during the early 50s. And when he took this photograph with a very clear color wide-angle lens, he didn't see anything. And yet it showed up very clear. One of the clearest photographs I've ever seen. You don't see the metal of the ship, but the whole outline of the ship is there. It's a scout craft. And those are like our shuttle, except they, you know, they're more advanced. Obviously, they go from the planet's surface to a mothership. Those are the larger cigar-like looking crafts. They're more the research vessels that hold all the supplies and what have you. But it's in a very intense color. It's almost like a golden white. And the sky around it is a smoggish color. And the plant life is recording a blue, so that would mean a cold magnetic force is being passed not only through the air but through the plant life. And the most interesting thing to me is their common horizontal is now vertical to our planet at this stage, and it's hovering right in front of the photographer. This guy he claims he didn't see anything, so there was a cloaking effect going on. But it's really just it's just like our eyes don't pick up every vibration, our ears don't pick up every sound. We can only receive so much. We're limited. But I've been waiting to get on all night, and in fact, I've been working on people individually. And you know, it's going to sound like a rambling off at the mouth.
No, actually, Bob, you're not. I'm sitting here listening, and so is John Bedini, sitting across the table from me, just agreeing with most everything that you've said. John is one of our scientists in this country who has harnessed that free energy thing that we've been looking for. He has them in his laboratory.
Great.
And you'll be hearing more about that. John, you have any comments on some of the observations that Bob made, which seem to be right on?
Yeah, we just something to throw in here. I think you're familiar, Bill, with this new amplifier we created.
I certainly am.
With the where we took the old normal silicon devices, which are normally known as the common transistor, and now we're making them work in a new wave range, which is in the ultraviolet range. And these things actually glow in the dark. You can see them emit the ultraviolet greenish light, bluish green. All right.
Yeah. They're considered the finest amplifiers in the world.
And that thing is vibrating at a real high speed, but it's a non-linear device, just like you're talking about.
I see.
And it's what's left over that is the free. And if you capture that while you're on your way, aren't you?
Yeah, it's a matter of transmitting the cyclic energy. Of how you apply that energy into your motor drive, it has to be a complete cycle. I mean, our cars are completely inefficient. We've got about 8 or 9 different cycles we apply till we get to that one cycle, which we call a wheel. It's pretty funny, if you ask me. In any case, I do have this photograph, and if you're interested, I can pass it on to Mr. Padini and Mr. Green. I don't know if it would be of any interest to you.
It
but
would be of great interest to us.
Okay.
Bob.
All right. Well, I'm glad I was able to get on, and boy, you don't know how many times I've been turned down on other talk shows, and in fact, this show has been recommended to me by other people that I've cornered and practically scared to death, and then really helped them to see a lot of things for what they are, and I'm going to try and work on a remote-controlled ship sometime this year, so look for that.
Well, Bob, thank you, and I couldn't think of a better call to cap off our 3 hours tonight. Appreciate it very much.
God bless you all. We'll see you soon.
I hope so.
Take care.
And that's it. George Green has been with us, our guest, talking about E.T. on the phone from Tucson, Arizona, Wendell Stevens, and in studio, John Bedini, talking about spacecraft propulsion. I hope it was an interesting night for you. Kevin Ryerson will join me next week, and perhaps we'll hear from Tom McPherson while he is here. So join us then.